Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X, celebrating pride and the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women, creating sustainable size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection, obsessively fit tested for all day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit tomboyx.com.
I am reading a lovely memoir and essays called The Crane Wife by C.J. Hauser. I first read the title essay a few years ago in the Paris Review. It's about the dissolution of a relationship between the author, C.J., and her fiancé, who was emotionally withholding, distant, a cheater, and a gaslighter. It's about what we need, what we can survive with, what we deny ourselves while lying to ourselves. And it's no surprise to learn that the entire memoir is as outstanding as that initial essay, which I'm going to link to in the show notes. The writing is elegant, airy, precise. The author has a really compelling voice. I'm reading an advanced copy, but the memoir comes out on July 12th, so I highly urge you to add it to your to-read list if you enjoy the title essay. From Luminary, this is the Roxane Gay Agenda, the bad feminist podcast of your dreams. I am Roxane Gay, your favorite bad feminist. On the Roxane Gay Agenda, I talk about things that are on my mind, and then I find interesting people to speak with about what's on their mind. This week, we're talking about the art of memoir and cultural criticism and the intersections between. I do not think of myself primarily as a memoir writer because I write cultural criticism and fiction and screenplays and all kinds of other things. But once in a while, sometimes more, I do delve into the personal. I like to hold things close, maybe too close, but sometimes my work demands disclosure. I try to be careful about the when and the how, but it requires a willingness to be vulnerable or an ability to tolerate vulnerability despite feeling terrified. And a lot of times people will phrase this as courage, but it's not. It's not. Like, courage is courage, and being able to withstand terror is something entirely different, at least for me. But one of the most curious things I have found in writing about the personal is that people assume that they know the entirety of who you are, when in fact, you know very selective pieces of information. Most of the memoirists I know, myself included, are some of the most private people you will ever meet. The reason that they disclose is because they have the ability to do so on their own terms, and they have the ability to withhold all of the things they truly don't want you to know about. I've been thinking a lot about the ways in which we can bring the personal into our writing, as I've been thinking about the work of today's guest. Margot Jefferson came to memoir after a long and illustrious career in cultural journalism. In the 1980s, she was a contributing arts editor at Vogue, and she went on to become a book reviewer and theater critic for the New York Times. In 1995, she won a Pulitzer Prize for her book reviews and cultural criticism, and then she started writing books. First, a cultural study of Michael Jackson, and in 2015, she came out with Negroland, a memoir. Negroland is, in fact, a book I know pretty well by now. I've not only read it probably 10 times at this point, I've been working on a TV adaptation of it that will hopefully be on your television screens in the next 2 years. It focuses on the world of upper-middle-class Black people in Chicago in the 1950s and 60s, and it is at once incisive and lush and absolutely brilliant. Margot has a new book out, and this one is called Constructing a Nervous System. Margot Jefferson, welcome to the Roxane Gay Agenda.
Well, thank you, Roxane. I'm happy to be on this agenda.
Excellent. I wanted to start with your writing process. I've heard that it's very involved and it doesn't begin with writing. I would love to know, what does a good writing day look like for you?
A good writing day looks like First, I'm ready in some way to sample and improvise. That may be to get the mind and the heart and the spirit operating. That may be particular kind of music. It may be some reading, mm-hmm. maybe a poem. Or when I was doing reviews regularly, I had a very adept sense of what reviewer I might read, maybe from several centuries back, maybe last week, who in some way would be kinetic, would get me interested, get me on the page. I also tend, a good writing day starts with a certain amount of, I wouldn't say exactly free association, but association. I often use song lyrics that I will just scribble out or, you know, juxtapose to get myself going. And I think all of this has to do with first waking up all your senses as well as your brain, but giving myself, we writers need the illusion that we have lots of choices each day, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, it's my workout, my you have choices workout, Margo.
Where do you go from sort of getting yourself creatively invigorated? What kinds of research do you do? Because one of the things I've noticed, especially about your criticism, is the depth of knowledge. I was reading your new book and I learned so much about Ella Fitzgerald that I had no idea about. So I would love to know more about like where you get to those details and then how you connect them to these like larger cultural points that you want to make.
I start with the most obvious, a biography. There were some very good essays in the last several years about, well, reportage, about Ella and the School for Wayward Girls, the institution for wayward girls she was in. So I start collecting material. I take notes on it, and I start, as I'm getting all the material I need, I do two things. I start organizing it according to where I think I'm going. That's one. I star or check off the points that even if they don't seem to fit, they interest me. Also with music, I always, whether I'm writing about a singer, a musician, a dancer, I will go back and look at YouTube, you know, at videos over and over and over.
That level of immersion, you know, that takes so much time and dedication. I love that you are willing to put in that work because a lot of times, as I'm sure you've noticed, a lot of critics today are, because of the demands of the market, forced to really get something out almost immediately. When something happens, I have emails in my inbox like literally 30 seconds after it happens.
Yes.
And then they say, can you file within 2 hours?
No. Yeah, exactly.
And no good work is really going to happen. What was it like, you know, writing in the 1990s, especially at the times when it was a different era and you were given more time? Have you found that you've had to change your process as you've sort of written your way into present day?
You mean written my way from pieces of a certain length, whether they were reviews or, as we sometimes more loftily aspire to think of them and call them, essays, right?
Yeah.
As I moved from those to writing a book.
Yes.
Well, first of all, you know, the flip side of having a limited period of time is instant gratification. You get excited and you basically, you're pleased. A book, it requires delayed gratification. You have to keep finding ways to go forward. Each day feels different. I really had to keep reminding myself that they all had to be part of
it. That it was going to come together.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yes, I'm in the middle of a book right now, and I am trying to remind myself that ultimately all of these little pieces that I'm working on are going to cohere into a singular narrative.
Yeah. And you have to tolerate more false starts, don't you find?
I do find, especially with, I'm writing a book of writing advice, and,
ooh,
you know, I know, I know. And a lot of my writing process, you know, certainly I do research and I spend a lot of time reading. And
yeah,
it's hard to articulate how I then translate and sort of digest everything that I'm learning into an essay or a short story or a novel. It just kind of happens. Mm-hmm. And so how do you just tell people, like, sometimes you, like, it happens.
Yeah.
And so I just keep going down these roads trying to figure that out.
But, you know, I like this expression that I started to use, I think maybe after I left the Times, dream space.
Mm.
You know, that's what's going on. You're reading, you're researching, you're thinking, you're da-da. And then there's that dream space where you're mm-hmm. doing something else. Often I find when I'm researching, if I'm feeling, okay, I'm in the groove, researching is calming. Mm-hmm. You know, reading other books is calming. That helps with the dream space. Something unconscious or semi-conscious can be going on when you're doing this more formal work. And then that might show up the next day.
I love those unexpected moments when something you don't think is going to show up actually ends up showing up. It's yes. incredibly satisfying. Like, ah, that's why I learned that little piece of information.
Exactly. Exactly.
This is where it belongs.
Yeah.
Let's hit it. Give me a vacation.
Vacation.
Give me a wave.
Surfing.
Give me a city tour.
The trolley.
Give me animals.
The zoo.
Give me some sea life. Give me museums.
Balboa Park.
Give me a woo.
Roller coaster.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your family vacation at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. Celebrating pride and the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women. Creating sustainable size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection. Obsessively fit-tested for all-day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit TomboyX.com.
When you're writing cultural criticism and essays, do you need to feel a personal connection to the work to really be moved to engage with it?
That is very much my preference. You know, mm-hmm. periodically when you're on a beat, you know, as I was for years before the Times too, as a book reviewer or a theater critic, you have to find, you know, if there's a play, big Broadway opening, you know, or just a well-regarded writer who's got something on stage or published it, and you're assigned it, you have to find a way to be interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that can be arduous and irritating, but it can also be useful. It can try out different muscles. I am much happier when I'm picking the piece or the editor and I are totally agreed, you know, it's a good fit, mm-hmm. and I start off by feeling some kind of connection, you know, even if, again, it transmutes itself into something I didn't expect, or, oh, God, yeah. I'm more ambivalent about that, or, well, wait, I'm angry at this part of that. Okay. But the connection is there.
And I find the same thing. If I'm invested, if I care, the writing is going to be that much better. And you know, I can do passable writing if I'm not feeling the connection, certainly, because not anymore, but especially early in my career, you just have to be able to get it done.
That's right.
And now I do try to only work on things that I really want to work on and just say no to the things that I don't honestly have any interest in. And, you know, especially as a Black woman, people often think that the only thing I want to write about is going to somehow connect to race. And,
yes.
you know, that's so limiting. There's so much more to who I am and how I understand the world. And I know for you, you were doing cultural criticism, especially early in your career, at a time when not a lot of Black women were doing it.
No.
And what was that experience like, having to be sort of the only one?
Oh, it was sometimes, you know, some days they were ordinary. You know, I simply felt, okay, here I am. There were many more women, usually white, and Blacks, usually men, in the world of journalism when I entered it, you know, which was in the 70s. That actually did help. It meant I wasn't in every way in terms of gender and race alone, you know, mm-hmm. and so it meant there were common grounds for the problematic, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
I was very aware that nothing I said or wrote would be taken for granted, that it was always being filtered through other people's perceptions, some of which mm-hmm. were complimentary, some of which were very negative, some of which were, as you were saying about memoir, mm-hmm. readers thinking, oh, I know you, some of which were smart enough, but kind of presumptuous. I was also very aware that, this goes back to something you were saying too, I was there and I was being a critic because I wanted to bring attention to what we now call these canons in the making, you know, of women writers and international writers and Black writers and Indigenous writers. And I couldn't pretend I knew all those worlds equally well. So, you know, I had to do my research, but I knew that was an agenda in my heart as well as my mind. I also felt very strongly I'm involved with a lot of cultural artifacts, experiences, artworks. I'm not going to be stopped from writing about, you know, anything that, you know, let's say it's white, male, heterosexual art. You know, I had a lot of training in all that. And I, you know, I had judgment and preferences and tastes, and I felt I have contributions to make here too. So I really made sure to stay a moving target in those ways.
I can really relate to staying a moving target. You know, I often say you're never going to know what I'm going to do from one project to the next.
That's the thing. And that's also how you keep yourself interested.
Absolutely. I find that it keeps me creatively nimble and it helps me to be better and try to write some more effectively and just challenge myself because I don't want to write the same old sort of criticism over and over. I want to try new things. And I also am interested in art, visual art. I'm interested in theater, both musicals and plays. I'm interested, of course, in books and music. And so by focusing on a lot of different things, you know, I also get to sort of keep that muscle flexible.
Yes. And, you know, it's also the way one attends to how these cultural forms, their status, their experiments, how they change. You know, when I was a child in the 50s, we were all obsessed with TV, but it was monitored. You can't watch but so much because it's basically fun junk. You know, except for those uplift programs like The Voice of Firestone, where opera singers would always appear. Television has changed wildly in many ways. It's what it's willing to do, its experiments, its form. And so you have to adapt to that. You know, you have to retune and attune yourself, you know, to a world that's operating differently and that requires different things of you and even requires you to look back on the things you took for granted, you know, whether it's Amos and Andy or I Love Lucy, and, you know, reconfigure them.
Now, I know in 1995, you won a Pulitzer Prize.
I did.
And for many of us, that is the apex. So how do you stay ambitious after reaching the mountaintop?
You know, I think at first I was in shock and I didn't feel, oh, this is everything's finished. But I did feel, huge stage fright with a little bit of paralysis. You know, what can I live up to? Will the world see that I'm living up to? But I knew I hadn't written, among other things. There were kinds of journalism I still hadn't done yet. I was mostly doing books. I'd started to do more cultural criticism, but I hadn't yet done theater. I hadn't yet done my column, which was my critic's notebook, which was really about whatever in the culture I wanted to write about. So I knew there was more, and I hadn't written any books. And I knew that I wanted to. So these resources needed to be gathered. You know, I wasn't old enough to feel, ooh, you can end it now. You know, you can, you can be retired to that emeritus board. So you know, it was nerve wracking and it was, but I knew more is required, Miss J, is what I said to myself. Yes.
You pivoted to memoir, or not necessarily pivoted, but you expanded your repertoire to memoir.
It was a pivot too. It was,
And one of the things that first struck me, I read Negroland when it came out because I reviewed it.
I remember.
It was not a typical memoir. It wasn't, I was born, I lived, and here I am today. Instead, you were really chronicling Negroland. How did you decide, I'm going to write about this community I was raised in?
I had, again, these ideas, these worlds sit in your mind for years. And you keep saying, I need to write about this because it's not very well known. It's often misunderstood. It's my parents were aging, you know, and I wanted to capture things that would never, you know, that would disappear with them. They were part of this ongoing history and they stretched back. That was in my mind. After I finished Michael Jackson, I thought, you have to take this risk. I have always been, well, not always, that sounds a little grandiose, but this space where the cultural and what we think of as the personal mingle and intermingle, and the ways in which I would say, particularly for peoples of color, the ways you are always modulating, you know, over here, even with your family, you may be.
Yes.
I'm playing the good child, the good black child at a certain point in history. Then, you know, you're doing something else that's entirely, you know, you're listening to a song, you're reciting a poem, you're acting out in some way that's entirely, as you see it, yourself, you know. So there are also many, many roles, many, many masks that you are required to don. The mask of the perfect student, the mask of the very, very bright, you know, child, the mask of the decorous girl, the mask of ambition that, and this was so true for women in the 50s, ambition that makes clear, you know, you will succeed, you will use your brain and your good education, and you will be a credit to your race and sex, but you're not going to overdo it. You're not going to let those ambitions and achievements get in the way of your proper destiny as a female. Marriage and children, which it seemed I did not do.
And yet.
So, you know, all of that, it's so performative, that culture. It's a word we overuse, but it really is. That helped me because I realized this world is not set up so that there is one uniform line of how you live, how you behave. My particular historical situation, growing up in the 50s, then turning 12, 13 as the 60s approached, and, you know, and the world broke open with all these movements. Of course, that couldn't be an orderly arc. I also kept coming up against, if you will, what I thought of as the memoirist's scene making and confessional and meditative voice, and what I knew was my critic's voice. So when I realized that being a critic was as crucial to identity, which is always a key subject of memoir, when I realized that was just as crucial as my relations with my parents, you know, my crushes, etc., then I could go forward. I was very stymied at one point until the other thing that was a realization was how I virtually opened the book, where I say, I was taught not to, to reveal unflattering, unseemly facts about myself or about the world around me, because that would be turned against our race. And once I put that down, I could violate it.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X, celebrating pride and the queer community all year. Queer founded, queer run, and the makers of the original boxer briefs for women, creating sustainable size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies, so you feel comfortable in your own skin. Tomboy X just dropped their Pride 24 collection, obsessively fit tested for all day comfort in sizes 3 extra small through 6X. Visit TomboyX.com.
You know, it's interesting, the modulation. I grew up in a strict Haitian household, Haitian American, always sort of comporting ourselves the right way was a huge part.
Yes.
It was just a huge part. And I always found that writing was the place where I could step away from that level of comportment and modulation and express myself. Was writing sort of that for you, or did you find yourself, and do you find yourself modulating yourself and thinking about comportment, achievement, reflection on your community in your writing?
It is both. Mm-hmm. I am always negotiating or crossing back and forth that space between, oh, I can say what I want to say and I can try out this. And this also has to do with, you know, having been a critic in mainstream publications for years and a certain kind of, call it critical comportment, a certain temperature. And that also has to do with assignments. You know, every magazine has its own, or newspaper has its own particular temperature, its own way of modulating. They want your individuality. You're not an interesting critic without persona that interests, but they want it also within the conventions that they have. Mm-hmm. So that's always been tricky. That's another reason I, first of all, started with Michael Jackson. I did need to transition to memoir, but I knew everyone's opinions, feelings, you know, research is into him. We're all totally torn, conflicted, uncertain, vulnerable, tempestuous, adoring. And I thought, okay, that's going to be good for me because that has to be folded somehow into the text.
One of the things that struck me most in Negroland was the way that you were both incredibly critical of the community, but also nostalgic. There were so many things about the community that you clearly were connected to, that you loved. And of course, that's understandable. I think we all have that affinity and ability to criticize the communities that we rise from. And so how do you manage to hold space for nuance in your work, and especially in your memoirs?
I think by continually rereading myself as if I were not only the participant, you know, the monologuist, but as if also I were a critic, assessing exactly those distinctions, differences. When I even say at times in the book, am I being sentimental? Am I being, am I being a little self-indulgent here? I guess I'm angry. Oh, I'm going to switch from first to second to third person, and this is why. It's a form of surveillance in a way, but it's also critical inquiry, and it's not exempting yourself from that. Also, I believe in trusted friends who are really good readers. And by trusted, I mean not only do you love them and respect their mind and brain? You can trust them to say,
yes.
You're indulging yourself there.
I'm grateful for having that.
Yeah,
for good readers. Because sometimes you look at work in the world and you think, you don't have any friends. there's no one there to tell you, step back from that ledge.
That's right.
Don't do it.
And you can't step back all the time. You just can't.
There are so many times where I look at something and I'm just so attached to it without external feedback, I am not able to step away from that ledge.
That's right.
That's why I'm incredibly grateful for my editors and my most trusted readers. I don't have many trusted readers. That's not.
No.
But I have enough.
Exactly. Exactly. And all you need is one good book editor, you know. And if you've got that too,
it's a gift.
It is.
It is absolutely a gift. Now, your new memoir is called Constructing a Nervous System, which is such an interesting title and conjures up a lot of different things for me. What is behind that title for this book?
What's behind it is my desire to, and my sense that these experiences, these objects, this ephemera, all this stuff that's part of our personal culture has marked and shaped us every bit as much as the psychological material, the historical material, the geographical. And that if you are continually looking at what there is there, rearranging it in some way, curating it inside your own psyche, and letting new materials come in and mark it, then it is possible to stay alive, actually, not to keep repeating yourself emotionally, psychologically, as a writer.
This book also, like Negroland, is not a typical memoir with a beginning, a middle, and an end, which I loved. It's very circuitous. It's kind of like a nervous system in that it reaches everywhere. And so I was wondering how you thought about structure when you were putting this book together, because I loved the structure.
You know, thank you very much. First, I really focused on the subjects, the figures, the memories that I knew I was obsessed with. And then I began to think through, feel through, how are they connected to each other in this brain and psyche of mine? What's the relationship between how I rationally connect them and what's in fact irrational? I mean, nothing I wrote about Ike Turner is exactly rational, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. How do I get past through what my own past relationship with these figures has been? And how are they set in motion by, how do they affect this personal life of mine, these particulars? I can't, you know, that the first part of the piece that ends with Ella Fitzgerald is really about Bud Powell.
Yes.
And it turned out all my intense feelings about Ella Fitzgerald were also connected with the powers of Black male jazz musicians, how a Black female with very few of the usual glamour tropes, uh-huh. How she could, as a genius, how she could make her way, what disguises were necessary for that. My father showed up, my uh-huh. own class anxieties. I mean, you know, sweat is kind of lower class. It should, from childhood and adolescence, uh-huh. all of that found its way in. And that's what I was after. That's the nervous system.
That's interesting.
And also things you can't fully resolve necessarily. Uh-huh. In a certain way, I did resolve the Ella because her genius resolved it. But many yes. of the other things there are not. Willa Cather's not resolved.
You know, no. The Willa Cather was eye-opening. I mean, I learned a lot reading this book. And I'm from Nebraska.
Oh, my God. I didn't know.
Yes. Yeah, Omaha, Nebraska. Oh, and so Lord. Willa Cather is a very big deal
very.
In Nebraska. And this offered really a more complex portrait of some of her issues, as all of the writers from that time had.
Yes.
You know, race.
Yes.
Either they ignored it, or they exploited it, or they took things for granted that we now recognize as absolutely unacceptable. And so to see her, who's so revered, getting that kind of treatment was wonderful and unexpected.
Good. I'm glad. There, too, you know, part of the critique was very firm and finished and final. And the fact is, I still love some of her work. So that's there, too. So I was so interested in how can love, dislike, hate, uncertainty, how can they mutate? You know? How can they take more than one form? How can they collaborate?
Uh-huh. You write about your parents in the memoir. You also write about them in Negroland, but in this one, you bring out more, especially your father's depression.
Yes.
And the ways in which you were wounded by that depression. Now that they've passed on, was that freeing you up in some way to write more about them?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
Negotiate with their lives?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My mother was still alive while I was writing a lot of Negroland, though she uh-huh. died before. And she was alternately, oh, I'm so excited that you're doing this. I was not showing her what I was doing. And you know, Margot, I'm a very private person.
Mm, yeah. My mom says that all the time.
Yes.
And, and I'm like, don't you worry.
That's
Do
right.
not worry.
Don't worry. And many of her friends were still alive. And a part of me was still the daughter and the, you know, the niece, the whatever, Irma and Ronald's child, who wanted in some way to please. So I had to really protect that material for myself. It definitely helped me find access to a wider range of feelings, responses, of ways of seeing them. I don't think I ever let myself show all out anger to my mother in Negroland. And I adored her. That's one reason. Uh-huh. She was funny. She's charming. She's all of that. The fact, in part, of her death helped me access not only how much I missed her, but how angry I was yes. at some of that legacy.
Of course.
Yeah.
And that comes through in the second book, Constructing a Nervous System. And because in Negroland, you seemed very upfront, but respectful. I mean, and this book is extraordinarily respectful, too. But here we see that you peel back more layers.
Yeah, and the same with my father. I think understanding his melancholia, his depression, and the sort of ardor with which he kept going, I think I had worked on that, or I wouldn't be able to talk about, you know, depression myself. But I wasn't ready to make it public. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering now, because he had already died when I wrote Negro Land. So I'm wondering now if in some part of me was still protecting the upright, honorable, exemplar of the race figure of my father. And depression in some way mars that or undermines it. Yeah.
It can't. I mean, especially I think in Black communities.
Exactly.
We do tend to keep mental health not only private, but incredibly intimately secret.
Exactly. And it can, which means if we're saying private and secret, then the word shame is not far behind.
Correct. Right? Correct. And it's interesting to see how many men of that generation, my father's generation, carried quite a lot on their shoulders. And I think quite a lot could use with some Prozac.
Oh my God. Which in his later years was it wasn't Prozac. It was one of those, it wasn't something like Milltown. My father in his later years was often doing these mild versions of these tranquilizers. Yes. Just to keep a steady keel. Yeah.
Just to keep going.
That's
you know, one of the things you do tackle in constructing a nervous system is the ways in which your father's memories of the past were shaped and really marred by racism, and your mother resented that at times, and you've tried to resist taking those memories on. How have you tried to reconcile the ways in which racism really, I think, probably contributed to your father's melancholia and the ways he understood the world?
I don't know if one ever reconciles it. I recognize, and in that way, Negroland's historical parts were helpful. I recognize that no man of that generation, no Black man of that generation escaped. Whether you know, I read other Black writers have really, in fiction, in nonfiction, documented this. So it helps when you can see that something that marked and maybe maimed you, not maybe, did maim you in some ways personally, and it made him more distant. That's another thing. When those things are historically grounded, that calms you. You can still be deeply angry, but there's not that I have to take this personally all the time. This is what was done to me. It's also what was done to him.
Yeah.
And I'm here, and I'm younger, and I, in some certain ways, had it easier. So it interests me, and I think it's also my job to make real sense of it.
One of the things this book really does illustrate is that we are made by culture, in addition to our families and the communities, and that we are shaped by these significant cultural events of our lives. Not only books, but movies, music.
Yes. Tiny
cultural incidents like the Oscars.
Yes. Thank you. Hello. Yes. We've been marked.
I mean, we're going to be talking about that for a minute.
Exactly.
And so what kinds of cultural events in recent years have grabbed your attention, both as a critic and as a person?
You know, that's tricky because the last couple of years I've been so immersed in writing this book. But I mentioned earlier, you know, TV. Of course, I'm interested in all the permutations and surprises of Atlanta. I've been watching more African and Korean film than I ever have before because it's available. I keep up with postmodern Black dance, one might say, and postmodern white and mixta dance. One of the things culturally that's interesting to me is how much one is still, I listen to myself talking, involved in these binaries. It's white this, it's Black that. The fact is, our cultural world, yes, I mentioned Koreans, but the cultural world is extremely varied. And we might find that we are in one part of it that we know very, very well, and then suddenly exposed to traditions and legacy, however sympathetic and supportive we are, that we are kind of ignorant about. know, so I'm finding Absolutely. So often I'm a novice again, uh-huh. including with pop music. I don't mean.
Yeah.
Don't
get me started on music.
Yeah.
Don't get me started. Every time I watch the Grammys now, I'm just like, wait, who
are these people? That's right.
I don't know. And I never thought I would get there. I always thought, I stay current. I'm on top of this.
Well,
and then I watch the Grammys and I just think, I know Beyonce.
We do know her. That's right.
And that's, but I also take note and then I go try and listen to their music so that I can not necessarily keep up, but just know what's happening musically in the world. Because left to my own devices, I'm going to listen to 90s R&B and hip hop. That's just what I'm going to do.
That's
musicals. And so I stay in my lane and then I'd like pop out every now and again.
I understand. Yeah. So, now that I've finished this book, I'm also curious about where I'll be led next, what I'll decide. Mm-hmm. Margo, get it in gear, and really check this out.
Margo Jefferson. Thank you so much for coming on the Roxanne Gay Agenda.
Oh, you know what we used to say in good girlhood? Thank you so much. I had a very nice time.
As did I.
Thank you, Roxanne.
Margo Jefferson's latest book is Constructing a Nervous System, a memoir. It is out on April 12th at your favorite bookstore or a library. You can keep up with me and the podcast on social media, on Twitter at rgay and Instagram at RoxanneGay74. Our email is RoxanneGayAgenda@gmail.com. From Luminary, the Roxanne Gay Agenda is produced by Curtis Fox. Our researcher is Yesenia Moreno. Production support is provided by Caitlin Adams and Meg Pillow. I am Roxanne Gay, your favorite bad feminist. Thank you so much for listening.
Ready? Let's go. Give me a vacation.
Vacation!
Give me a golf course.
70 courses!
Let's get a water sport.
Paddleboarding!
Can I get excursions?
Whale watching!
Time for chill vibes.
Beach yoga!
How about a garden tour?
Balboa Park!
Give me a dolphin. What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Happy Pride from Tomboy X. We just dropped our Pride 24 collection. Queer founded, queer run, and creating size and gender inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. So you feel comfortable in your own skin. Visit TomboyX.com to shop.